welcome to Comfortably Unnumb, the official podcast of the Umbrella Society. My name is Blake Anderson. I'm the host of this podcast. I'm also the programs manager here at the Umbrella Society. Coming to you today from beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, on the traditional unceded territory of the Lekwungen-speaking people. And what a podcast I have for you today. Upon popular demand, I have Jeff on the program. Jeff is an employee with us. He's been working for us for the past year on a couple different programs through Umbrella. He is also a facilitator, a smart facilitator that runs our group on Thursday nights here at the office. And he's a guest facilitator at our one-month intensive outpatient program, Comfortably Unnumb. Full circle moment, Jeff, just a little over 2 years ago, was a participant in Comfortably Unnumb when he was just starting his recovery journey. Such a character. I've had multiple people reach out to say that they think Jeff would be an absolutely incredible guest on this program. And man, were they right. Just both a unique and absolutely authentic individual and somebody who has quite the story to tell. I'm really proud to present Jeff. Okay, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on. I know, I didn't give you much prep time here. I think I only asked you last week to do this, but couple of people that actually suggested that I get you on. I think you're a very colorful character, and people, it really resonates. I think your approach to recovery. So there's multiple requests to have you on. So I appreciate you doing it and doing it
I
short
really
notice.
I appreciate you offering. I'm excited to be here, and I still remember meeting you first in Uncomfortably Numb at the very beginning of my journey in recovery. It was funny. I still make jokes about Uncomfortably Numb and ask the other participants in it about, did you do this quinoa push?
That's right. So for those who don't know, when I do my, I run a couple of sessions in our 1 month intensive group, Comfortably Unnumb. And one of my sessions is health and wellness. And I am a huge quinoa fan. And I make sure that everybody knows the benefits of quinoa. And Jeff makes sure that everybody is aware that if, I'm the quinoa guy. I'm sure I should get some kickback,
You should. Yeah. And cold water dunks.
That's right. The things I'm passionate about, I make sure people know about. So that's great. Well, I'm glad that I, had a lasting impression. And like I said, it is really cool to have you come now at this stage of your recovery and just to see, an amazing amount of work you've put in the last couple of years
years and a bit in recovery.
Yeah.
Quite a journey.
And like I said, seeing you, somebody who really, I felt like every session that was offered, through that group Comfortably Unnumb, that it was really, you were taking a lot in. You were somebody who really brought everything to the table and really added to the vibe of that whole group. And that was a really special group that came through. That was a really special cohort.
It was
cohort.
Really wonderful having that group, because it was like after I'd gone to Bridging Care at EMP, Eric Martin Pavilion with Mental Island Health, it was another stable thing. It was another routine.
Right.
And it brought me right back to more routine and got into the community of recovery. And it was it was challenging, but I loved it.
Right.
It was so much fun.
And now we're kind of at the place and we'll, of course, we're starting the end here. But it's really cool to see, now working in the field and doing facilitation of your own. I would love, as we were just talking about, I do have a, usual form with these chats and diving back a little bit and hearing some backstory. I think it's really important to kind of get context and to know, what life was like, before and where addiction kind of first started showing its face in your life. It's everybody's story is so unique and different for you. Where is your history? Where do you feel like, that started for you?
Around grade, probably nine, when my father, he passed away at that point, but he had slowly died at home by, hepatitis. Okay. And, after he passed away, I kind of, ventured into alcohol, but before that I'd smoked a little bit of pot. So, but ended up venturing into alcohol and, severe grief. And I had done lots of counseling throughout my childhood. I had done counseling because I'm ADHD severe. Mm-hmm. And I was done, there was tests done on me and lots of weird stuff. And then lots of stuff up at UVic. And then I'm dyslexic, but okay. And I used to call myself functioning illiterate. Now I just say I have a problem. You know, I'm not functioning illiterate. I can function.
Right. But
yeah, so severe learning disability, really bad attention deficit or ADHD. Right. And then alcohol showed up and I was able to escape. I was able, and I found this thing that made it so that I could not feel. And I loved it. And it was great. It was the best thing ever. And then around smoking pot, that kind of stuff too, all throughout high school. But by the time I was 18, no, I was just 17. I was so engulfed into into alcohol and drugs, just pot at that point, and acid and mushrooms.
Right. But so basically the party drugs, essentially. Yeah.
The gateway, the fun kind of stuff.
Right.
The usual.
But, so this was an escape in high school. Was this a weekend thing for you, or where was the use? You know,
it was blackouts every weekend and then use throughout the week, but usually just minorly during the week.
Okay.
But it got to a point where every time I would eat or every time I would drink, I would vomit. So, and I was getting jaundice. And
At what age was this?
That was about 17, 18.
Okay, so the drinking had gotten to that point at an early, okay.
Yeah, so then I ended up going to doctors, and doctors were like, hey, you got two choices. You you quit drinking, you stop eating meat, you do all those dietary things, and we won't have to do some operations, but because I wasn't able to, I was drinking Pepto-Bismol as I was drinking liquor.
Okay.
So that was my first stint at recovery. I decided, I'm going to stop drinking.
Right.
And I did. I didn't do anything, kind of just had a normal little life. But at the same point, I traveled to Mexico to kill myself. Yeah.
Oh, when was this? So obviously
this was about 18, just after high school.
Okay. So your father passes away at 14, and probably not processing that as a 14-year-old would not.
No.
Was there any kind of, supports kind of offered to you?
I was going to counseling, grief counseling. I was in group counseling with kids during grief. Oh, yeah. And,
but really at the end of the day, something was, the whole still, and the drinking basically was filling that.
It worked.
Void.
Right? It worked. I felt great.
So when
I didn't care about my disabilities and all that. So I was perfect in community. I was like, I was a drug dealer. So I was
so there's a sense of identity.
Yeah.
And and so you're making money, you're kind of have this status.
That was the party.
And
I showed up, it was the party was on.
Right. So but obviously the bottom falls out at a really early age, like jaundice in your teenage years is we're pretty much invincible, at that point. But so you decide to stop. Is that when, obviously the depression or something else, when reality really starts?
Yeah.
How do you get to that point, going down to Mexico with that intention?
Because I was severely depressed. Later on, we'll find out that I was, I had my father had severe depression too, but I didn't know at this point and I didn't understand what that was. I was just really sad. Right. And I just was trying to go, I figured out that I couldn't kill myself. So I'm going to put myself in the most uncomfortable position and just die there. But so I traveled down there. I ended up crossing. I stayed with my uncle for a little bit in California. And then I crossed over into Mexico. And all I brought with me was a map of Mexico. I didn't speak Spanish. Nothing. Mm-hmm. And I just went onto the train. Or was it the bus? I can't remember. I pointed at a place. And they brought me there. And I got off the train. And somehow I got a hotel room. Right. Somehow I lived there for the next 5, 6, 7 days. I survived. And at that point, I was like, if I can survive this, I can survive anything.
Okay.
So then I ended up actually calling up my mom and being like, I need help. And then she came down and hung out with me for a little bit. And then I headed back home.
Right.
Yeah.
And that must have been a bit of a wake up call there. Hey,
in a sense? You would think so, but no. Okay. Not a wake up call in any way.
Really?
I got back here. And I ended up being invincible. I ended up meeting up with a new crew of friends. And that was the big era of the 90s with Kurt Cobain and all that. So we all started doing China White or heroin.
Yeah.
And it was like, one day we they were selling it. They were friends of mine, and we became called the family. Right. And we all sold lots of drugs. I was just doing acid and pot and stuff like that, but they were selling heroin and cocaine. Right. And we all hung out all together and looked after each other. And the progression of heroin was the scariest part of my life. It was, so this is 19. And, 19. I ended up 6 months. I went from the first time doing it to doing it all the time, smoking it and not injecting. That was a new level of, hey, I'm not really a drug addict.
Right.
I'm not injecting. I'm just doing it all the time. But that's drug acts.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That became quite a story of my life. But,
So I'm not an addict. I don't have a problem. I'm just smoking heroin every day.
And just all the time.
Yeah.
Hey, we're driving down the road. Hey, a couple of hits. There you go. Oh, here you go. Yeah. And I was functioning still. I was working, doing whatever. I think I was doing all right. Mm-hmm. And then I did that whole one day where I flushed my shit and fucking jumped in my van and drove and did that. What is it called? Where you go to a different area. I went to Edmonton, left Victoria.
Run away from your problems and everything will be fine. Right.
Yeah. So I got there and ended up, it was interesting. I really hate Edmonton. And I got a regular job. Like I'd spent just like all the other, I don't know. I had no money. I got there and I'd spent all my money from partying and doing whatever. Mm. And I got there and then I got a phone call a couple times that buddies had died. Friends of the family had died of overdoses and all that because they had started shooting. That's why one of the reasons I left. Everyone started shooting it up and I was I was scared.
Too much for me. You're right.
Yeah. I was like, it's funny that I was doing more of it than they were, but they were just now shooting it up.
Right.
But I was like, I'm good.
Right.
But yeah, so I got to Edmonton, was there for like 6 months, got a job as working at a car wash place. What a change that was. And then I got really sick. I ended up getting a thing called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is basically my white blood cells attacked our peripheral nervous system.
Okay.
And I looked like I had a stroke. So I showed up at the hospital. They quarantined me. And then they told me I was going to, you're going to get sick, but you're not going to die. I was like, okay. So I tell people, if a doctor ever tells you you're going to get really sick, but you're not going to die, be scared. Be scared. I was like, okay. And they said, call your mom now. So I called up my mom and I was like crying. I'm like, mom, I think I'm really sick. And the nurse is like coming within the next 24 hours. So my mom jumps over there. It progresses for about a month where my, I lose the ability to walk, talk, see. I'm fully paralyzed. They're doing hundreds of tests on me, testing me for everything under the book because, spinal taps, everything.
Right.
They basically tell me, okay, what's going to happen is you're going to have a moment where your heart's going to stop. And we have the machines out front. And then they showed me the, whatever it's called, the bad place in the hospital.
Right.
Where they're like, you're going to wake up in here with hooks up, tubes in your mouth, all that.
Yeah, I see you, yeah.
But you're going to be all right. You're going to be all right. Because then what it's going to do is the Guillain-Barré will, because it killed it, it'll re-kickstart your body. So it's basically like a computer. It had to turn off and turn back on.
Oh, my God.
So
that is an ominous prospect, hey?
Yeah. I was just like, okay. But I was, my body went, you know when your body goes numb?
Mm-hmm.
My body went numb for 30-40 days slowly, all of it going number and number and tingly, that tingly feeling.
Yeah,
that was what my body did at first, and then it just died. And it was all my external muscles, and then my internal muscles started shutting down.
Wow.
Yeah, so I ended up having a moment of like, I got them to wheel me into the bathroom, and this is like my safe place, always has been. They sat me down on the toilet, and I had my little walker and my hooks up things because I was like able to sit up enough that I could sit up. And I ended up praying to, I didn't believe in a God. I prayed to a higher power. I was just like, oh my God, I think I'm going to die. I don't want to die. I'll be good. I'll be good. You know, everything pleading.
So how old were you at this point?
I think 20.
20. Wow.
21 maybe.
That's quite something.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then I went back to the bed. And at this point, there's like a nurse basically sitting over there watching as I was going to die. Mm-hmm. And they, the next morning,
felt better. I felt something. I felt like a spirit, like my spirit was lifted, and I was like, okay. And I thought maybe I died, but no. And then it had kicked over, and then it started the rehab of next 3 months or 2 months of extreme rehab in the hospital, and then the next 6 months of rehabilitation when I came back home to Victoria, where I live with my parents.
Gotcha.
Yeah, or my mom.
There goes Edmonton.
Yeah, Edmonton's gone. We're done. We're home.
Right.
What else? Yeah, so that was my adventure there. Then I went through a stage where I was, I would say, reborn. I ended up deciding I wanted to live a life. I wanted to do things.
Right.
And I didn't drink, but I did a lot of psychedelics.
Okay.
I really was into like acid and mushrooms.
So was it kind of under the guise of, hey, I'm spiritual awakening, that kind of side of it? Or were you just...
I was taking epic doses and like experimenting. We were doing like drum circles and like, you know, weird, like getting naked in the forest, running around. Like, it was like, it was pretty spiritual.
Yeah.
It was awesome. But I traveled to, at that point, I got rid of having a permanent place I lived. So I lived in the Yukon in Dawson City, and then I lived down in Guatemala.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I did that for about 3 years, went back and forth doing that, where I was pretty clean. But a backstory, when I did the heroin thing, when I quit heroin, I ended up later on, around this time, I ended up talking to my doctor about it, and I got it put on my file that I'm not allowed to be given opiates because I was in fear of that, because it killed off. It ended up killing off about six of my friends. Out of our family of eight. So I was like, I want to know that that was my drug that I looked upon as dangerous.
Gotcha.
Everything else was fine.
You're fine. Yeah.
Everything else.
Where was alcohol in the mix? You just didn't drink or it was.
When I did drink, I drank excessively.
Right.
But I didn't drink that often.
Okay.
I found like psychedelics made it so I didn't drink really because I was scared to drink while I was high on acid or mushrooms because I couldn't regulate it.
Yep.
And I thought I'd, you know, kill myself.
Right.
And at this point, I was pretty high on life.
Okay.
Met a girl, ended up falling in love, got married, was smoking pot all the time, kind of like recreationally. Right. Like, I wasn't even a heavy pot. Yeah, I was a heavy pot smoker. I was like multiple times a day.
Right.
I ended up starting a business with this, with my partner, and, it was kind of like a interesting, I think we were together for 8 years or 8 or 10. And, because I was so occupied with running a business, it kind of directed all my energy towards that. Right. And then I became like quite successful owning houses and apartments and being like,
was that a business here in Victoria then?
Yeah. Or, the Joint Pizzeria and Deli.
Okay. Okay.
Owned it for 20 years.
I remember. Did you start that up then? Was that?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Yeah. I remember eating there many, many a time. Yeah. Okay.
Lots of people did.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay. So obviously there's stability for your first time, or at least outwardly there's stability.
I think it's, what's it called? Addictions, where they're not alcohol, drugs,
behavioral
addictions, where it's like I became workaholic.
Gotcha. And that became
my thing. And all throughout my life, there's been other addictions like that. Like I was very sexual at points where sex addiction.
Right.
And where it takes over my life. Or it ends up becoming gambling. I was really into gambling for a little bit.
Okay.
And it ends up becoming my focal point.
Gotcha. So it's the extremism almost of whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
So this one is like a healthier, you know, extreme, but it still pushes you to the point. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, running a business. Yeah. And
very unhealthy, but.
Right. Right.
You know, I would, in the eyes of society, I was
sure
I was doing really
good. You're making it.
Oh, yeah. I was in community. I was in, you know, what they called members of groups, like, you know, I don't know, nonprofits, and I was handing out money to like people like Umbrella and like I was like, oh yeah,
you're a reputable member of the community. That's right. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
I was involved with some fights against the city that got me notoriety and was asked at points to run politics, but. No, it runs, but that's a different story. We'll stick to addiction.
Sure.
But yeah, so I ended up doing, I really didn't pay attention to my wife. I mean, I loved her, but she had, she has her own mental illnesses or she has her own problems.
Right.
And we ended up just being growing apart. I didn't even notice. One day I came home and she was like, I'm done. I was like, okay, whatever. Right. Went back to, you know, I drink here and there, but it wasn't really, I think it's more smoking pot or becoming other fixated upon other things, like is mostly work. Right. I was actually, I think it was the cleanest I've ever been was during that.
Okay.
Like 10 years.
So it was fixation, but it, right. But it was work.
Yeah. 16 hours a day.
Right.
And then buying a house, redoing a house, buying a condo, buying all the shit, all the stuff, getting like all possessions and having like money. And that was important.
Yeah.
So she left and, I guess I'm going to step back. During the relationship with her, I ended up fighting with some mental illness.
Okay.
And, that was my depression and anxiety became unmanageable.
Okay.
And, I ended up having my doctor give me anti-anxiety pills, some sort of, not anti-anxiety, yeah, gave me anti-anxiety pills and Ativan Valium. Mm-hmm. That was the start of another great addiction. Right. And gave me, not the ones for depression, antidepressants.
Yeah.
Gave me one of those and, that ended up pushing me into like suicidal thoughts from being depressed, not being feeling like shitty to suicidal depression. So,
oh wow, so that adverse effects.
Oh yeah,
right. Okay.
Watching TV and I'd cry about bunnies and I had to tell my wife I was walking down the street and I'm like, I just want to throw myself in front of traffic. Like this is crazy. Yeah. Like I went there with my mom and my wife to my doctors and I told them, I said, hey, you got two choices. I'm not sleeping. Like I've always had problems sleeping.
Right.
And I told him, I said, you give me sleeping pills or knock me out in some way or drop me off. And I'm not taking any more of these pills or send me to the hospital. I'll get an ambulance call right now.
So you're cutting the, they weren't working obviously for you. Okay.
So, but that's when he handed me Zopicone and Valium or Ativan.
Right.
So that was the start of that. And that was around 26.
Okay.
So I'd continue on using those throughout my addiction until 2 years ago.
Right.
I was still on medication. You're supposed to be 6 months and it was 20 years later.
Wow. Okay.
But back to her deciding, my first wife deciding to leave me. She was my pillar.
Right.
The one thing that was always there. So now she left the country. She went back to her country. So she was really gone.
Yep.
Sold the house, owed a whole bunch of money, and I slipped straight into alcoholism. And then I found I'd been doing cocaine here and there throughout my life, but I hadn't had enough money to really do it.
Right.
So now I had money. I was just like, I know what I'm good. And guess aristocratic style of like, no, what is it called? It was around the people I was hanging out in the restaurant business and all the other, I'll call them movers and shakers.
It came with the territory almost, right?
Yeah. Okay. And we all did it. It was like, that was a part of it.
And it was, right. It's almost a supplementary to the party scene and the drinking, right? Yeah. It's just a supplement, right. Okay.
So I started doing that. I started partying. And then I got a sex addiction too, which was interesting. Right. I was just lonely. Ended up dating very extensively through Victoria. I was a 30-something year old, like I was making good money.
Right.
And but I was now doing not cocaine all the time, but every weekend a lot of times.
Right. And starting to creep itself into
And drinking like all the time.
Okay.
Like I was like missing work. I was like showing up to work drunk. I was like having my staff at that point, managers like being like, you have to go home.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Staff sending you home.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So I ended up, finally, it was like, I wasn't even looking at my books anymore. I'd given up. I was like, I'm partying. This is my time to party. I was good for like 8 years. I'm
making up for lost
time. Oh, yeah. And I did.
Right.
I had a pimping pad, rented a really cool apartment. It was like, I was king of bachelors.
Right.
But that was my accountant called me into the office one day and he was like, Jeff, I just want to sit down with you. You lost 55,000 last year. I was like, I lost 55,000. I'm like, oh, that's all right. He goes, no.
It's not okay.
Not all right. No, no, you lost too much money. And I'm like, oh, we use tax deductibles, whatever. He goes, no. You're going under. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm just like, I'll just keep writing checks.
Right.
The money comes in, money goes out. It's like, I know, it's gone too much money going out. So I kind of stepped back a little bit, and I ended up, I don't really know exactly, because I continued on drinking excessively, but I was able to function because I was now using cocaine a lot more.
Right.
And I was at work, so I could just be like, I could be drunk, but I could just do a couple rips, and there you go. I'm feeling better.
Yeah.
I'm back to normal.
Top of the world. Right.
Yeah. It's all right. And it worked perfectly. Made me focus. So the business got back up and running.
Right.
And it was good. Ended up meeting
right. But then you have this addiction that's just getting bigger and bigger, right? Or more.
Yeah.
So even though you could function, it's there. Okay.
Oh, right. It was, it was like, at that point I started hanging out with, I started becoming friends with drug dealers, and we were like, not that, people say, oh yeah, it's friends with my drug dealer. No. Like I was helping them out. Mm-hmm. I was a member of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And there was higher ups that I was getting to know, and it started becoming just basically a lot of, you do this for me, here's a big chunk. Oh, here, hold this for me, here's another big chunk. I'm like, okay, this is great.
Mm.
And they, they were looking after me too, because, I was new to their crew. They were a little, it was kind of funny. I was younger. I was older than them by like 3-4 years or 4-5 years in some cases. And I had some knowledge of this business.
Right.
But, I ended up marrying a second wife.
Okay.
This one we partied a lot.
Right.
It was right. It was.
So this was not going to be your pillar.
No. Right. This was like, we ended up going down a bad path, but it was like, but we looked good in the public. We looked great.
Right.
We were movers and shakers. We were invited to all the good parties. We were at all the special events. It was like we were at all the important things to be at and invited.
Gotcha.
Like,
yeah.
So we knew we could drop names. Like, it was dumb.
Right. So on a superficial level, this is looking okay, right? At the end of the day.
Yep.
So easy enough to convince yourself, this is great, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is like, now it's like we're doing cocaine on the weekends, like, a lot, like all, like the whole weekend, being up the whole weekend, sometimes a Friday too, maybe Mondays just to get up and going. But I'm now lying to my doctor about losing my pills. So I'm doing Ativan, Valium, and my Zolpidem at night for sleeping.
Right.
So,
and then a pile of blow.
And lots of drinking, excessive drinking.
Man.
So it's long story short, the marriage failed.
Right.
It was interesting. But at this point, I went straight right down. Now I was like, sometimes then I started kind of here and there, like, just when people wouldn't have cocaine, I'd be like, I'd smoke crack. I didn't like it.
Right.
And like, everyone's like, I love crack. I'm like, I fucking hate it. But it'd be like,
your dissent.
I didn't care.
Right.
Yeah. I'd just smoke it. Sure, there you go. And then someone would show up with coke, or I'd go grab some somewhere. And I'd be like, yeah, I'd rather do that.
Hmm.
This point, it ends up heading into, I'm with Island Health now at AOT, because I've had gone into, tried to get addictions.
Okay, so you went to the,
for mental health and addictions,
right? Yeah.
CARES clinic, the whole kit.
Okay, so you're starting, so you've recognized at least at this point, hey, I need help. The bottom's falling out.
Yeah.
You can't sustain that way of living for,
It's probably 8 years ago or something like that.
Okay, so you at least you went in, you kind of said, I need help, and they connected you with the AOT clinic, which is the addictions outpatient clinic through Island Health.
Yeah.
Okay, so you started getting some supports.
I went to some classes there. Sometimes I was high, sometimes I wasn't high.
Right. So you were doing something about it, but you weren't quite at that point.
No.
Right.
No, I was dating someone who ended up being working there.
Okay.
Yeah. We were in a relationship that went, I brought her down. But more and more and more drugs, more and more, and I was like, you don't have to go to work, and I stopped going to any kind of meetings, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I end up, then I ended that one. And then we're just heading into, it's the almost the beginning of COVID. Like it's just, it's a month or two before COVID. And I'm now like, I'm doing it all the time. Mm. It's like in the morning, at night, during the day. Right. Drinking's just a part of it. But I didn't really care about drinking. Drinking wasn't my bag.
That was, you weren't, right.
And I was hanging out at trap houses, like, even like in the last 3 years now, I've been like, 3 to 5 years, I've been hanging out at, you know, I'll call it a trap house, but it was just like a buddy's basement, dealer's house. And it was like other dealers would hang out there and we would just get high. Five dudes sitting around all night for 3 days,
right,
playing video games and getting fucking high.
Right.
But, and that was fun. That was the good times.
Right.
But yeah, I know I ended up, heading into COVID. I meet up with, my girlfriend, this is my last girlfriend. And, she's got, she has a mental illness. I think she was, bipolar, she had a head injury. Severe alcoholism. She liked drugs, but that wasn't her thing. Mm-hmm. She liked drinking. We ended up bunkering down together for COVID. That point, I'm doing cocaine all the time. It's just mm-hmm. like, we're like, I don't know, probably going through probably 2, 3, 8 balls, probably half ounce or more a week plus. I have no idea. Thousands of dollars.
Not sustainable.
No.
Either way.
Right. No, no.
Medically, financially, right. Yeah.
Okay. At this point, too, just before this, when I was with that other girl that worked in Island Health, I ended up meeting up with a psychiatrist. No, it was during COVID. I met off with a psychiatrist because I ended up having a stint where I was like, I need help. I can't stop this. Mm. And he prescribed me a whole bunch of other meds. So now I'm taking Ativan, Valium, Zolpidem, Seroquel, and some other pills. So my Ativan, it's the barbiturate, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I'm up to like, I don't even know, 8, 10, 12, 14 milligrams or whatever they are a day plus. And I'm just like, and I'm fighting. I would constantly take that drug and then take cocaine to counteract it and go back and forth and add alcohol in the middle.
Oh my God.
At the end of the night, I'd give myself a massive dose. I'd just keep taking as many pills as I could until I'd black out, which I'm surprised I didn't die.
Right.
I was kind of like, wow, Like now I look back, I'm like, because most times I didn't know what I was doing. Just take some more of these. Oh. Right. But so this new partner and me went down a rabbit hole of debauchery. Yeah. Police were called on a regular basis to the condo, like weekly. Police showing up, picking her up, taking her away to the drunk tank, you know, me leaving, her freaking out, throwing my shit out. We were exactly one of those people that right. The white trash having a meltdown every night.
All the neighbors are going, oh.
No one even, my apartment is really like, one cared.
Okay.
No one, and kind of, I wish they cared more.
Right.
I was like, sometimes I'd be like calling up the police and I'd be like, holy fuck, how can these people around me hear this? Because right. It's like breaking shit and me screaming and, okay. You know, we'd be like, she'd tackle me in the hallway and shit like that. And I'd be like, get away. So yeah, that was interesting. But, so there was a last, I guess at some point, she occupied my apartment for 6 months. Cause I was like, I can't live this way. Mm-hmm. I was doing tons of drugs. Mm-hmm. And I was all right with that and getting high all the time.
But it was the dysfunction.
It was so dysfunctional. It was right. That level of like coming home and she'd be like makeup all over her face and like, you know, drunk, falling down, hurting mm-hmm. herself. Right. And then when I'd kick her out or when she'd end up leaving or she went to detox two times during the COVID. Went to a treatment center, did a few other different stints, and it was great. But then she just relapsed instantly, and it would get worse, and then mm-hmm. there was constant fighting. So I was housed, but I was living at my business and living at a friend's house, and she was occupying my house. Right. And And I would come visit her. I'd stay when she was, when she was sober. And then she'd get, after a couple of days, she'd get wasted and it would go back to craziness. So one night, I came over the night before. And then when she ended up, I don't know, we had an altercation. I don't know exactly what happened. I left and I came back and then there's an altercation. She ended up freaking out. She called the police on me, just like the police had told me. Eventually what will happen, that she'll charge you with something. They arrested me. I was brought down. Ended up, I had a restraining order. Exactly what we see in my housing that I work at. Restraining right. order. I can't go by my house.
Right.
I was her one thing left in this world that was there for her. And the police took it away, or I took it away, or she took it away. One of us took it away from, and she ended up overdosing and dying on my deck.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, yeah, the police came down to my restaurant. I thought, oh, fuck, what is this now? I was like, oh, am I getting arrested? Or is she like, is she burning down my apartment? Mm-hmm. Is you know. And then they were like, no, she's dead. She overdosed and died.
Holy fuck.
And yeah, first I thought, you know what? I could have done more. And it was a counselor who told me, no, no, you did everything you can. You did everything. You did more. You gave her unhoused. Whenever she wasn't at your place, she would get beaten up in the street community. Right. She would end up falling down. She'd end up doing inappropriate things and upset people. She wasn't street entrenched.
Right.
She was an alcoholic with a drug dependency that I kind of feel like I was a part of.
Right.
Yeah. And she ended up, she ended up dying. So that was, that screwed me up.
I bet.
As bad as the relationship was, I knew that she loved me unconditionally. She cared for me. She might've been insane or she might've had, but she really loved me.
Right.
And now, I destroyed my relationship with my family at that point. I'd done weird stuff over there and I wasn't really talking to them. I was texting me once every couple of months or whatever.
Right.
They knew I was struggling.
Right.
My friends knew I was struggling before this too. I was talking about severe depression and, I just slipped into severe depression and just started not even really, I don't even know what happened. I was out there in La La Land. I was just doing a lot of drugs, trying to like, trying to numb it and not knowing how to numb it. And at the same point, trying to deal with like funeral and like cremating and like, cause she had no family.
Right.
And so, none of her family wanted to deal with it. Her family was, their response was, oh, we knew she'd be dead one day. And it was not what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I dealt with all that and I spiraled and I'd always had negative thoughts in my head. Always had been like beating myself up. Oh, you're stupid. You're dumb. Cause you know, I was told I was a child cause of learned disability. Right. And I'm fat and you're ugly. And I was like, oh yeah. And my thoughts started going like, I'd always been like for long since my first wife left me. I was always like saying one saying in my head, I hate myself. I want to die. I never figured out until this in recovery, how horrible that is. But I was like repeating that and I was just becoming, what is it called? Recluse in my apartment. Wasn't doing self-care. Wasn't doing anything. Was just doing drugs and trying to do other weird stuff, but wasn't even really, I was going over to friends' houses. Maybe they were, I was telling them I'd have breakdowns. I'd get so wasted. I'd somehow show up at their place all coked up, drunk and medicated. So they'd be like, they have videos of me, like I'm nodding off, but I'm coked out of my mind. Cause I'm just like, and
your brain's going into
different
directions.
And, finally. And I ended up, I decided I was going to kill myself. And, I ended up, and it was like, it was one of those things where it was like, I really decided. I looked up, I sat there and thought about it, figured it was like the best choice. I looked up how much medication I would take, how much would be, what medication would make it so I'd pass over the right way. I was too scared of fentanyl. I was still like, hey, heroin's for junkies. but right. I'm like, I'm killing myself. I was still like, I still have a had a fear of that drug.
Right.
So I ended up like looking it up, calculating it out, doing cocaine, got my liquor ready. I ended up doing a video for my mom, did a video for my friends. Wow. Ended up like planning it, woke up in the morning. This was the day. I opened the, for the first time, I opened the blinds. I was like, okay. Left the door unlocked so they could come in and get me. I was ready. It was mm-hmm. done. Mm-hmm. And I took my pills and started drinking and crying and drinking because it's like, you know, I was dying. I was ready. This was going to happen. And then somehow, I guess what I didn't know was the level of like when you take this the Zoplicone and these mixture of these drugs, they can cause you to have hallucinations. So I guess I was hallucinating and I was pressing buttons on my phone and I somehow sent a text. I sent the video to a friend of a friend. And he calls up my best friend. He goes, hey, man, it's a weird video Jeff sent me. I don't know what the fuck it is. It's weird. And they come over. I don't remember any of this. They come over. They can't get in the apartment, so they climb up my building. They go through my deck. They end up hauling me down. They end up trying to. They give me a whole bunch of cocaine first. So try to bring me back. Okay. So they thought, okay, bring him back. He'll bring him back. Because, like, you know, that's a, they didn't know what was happening. They knew, but they didn't want to. They didn't want to bring me to the police. They didn't want to bring me to the hospital. They wanted to, like, we dealt with it within the group, usually. Things were done. It was dealt with within our community. But it wasn't going to happen. So they grabbed me. In my arm, the one guy, big guy, lifts me up, I guess, been told. They throw me in the back of a car, drive me to the ambulance, drive me to the hospital. They end up basically walking into, not the emergency, but the other way.
Okay.
The one where the ambulance go in. They end up having, it's like two thugs going in there. Wow. And there's like, yeah, they get me in there. And I don't remember any of this. But I wake up. Like probably 2-3 days later, I don't have any recollection of this, but I'm in the hospital and I survived. You know, there's a catheter in me. It's kind of like, oh, I'm like, that's weird. How'd that get there?
Right.
I guess my mom has been there. Like some other friends had shown up too. I have no clue.
Right.
I don't remember any of it because of the amount of
lost days. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the amount of like, you know,
right.
Sleeping pills and the Ativan and all that. And I ended up, they got me to a room and I can remember this. The one part I can remember the moment that the doctor or not a doctor, a nurse, I was like, hey, can I go for a smoke? And the nurse was like, whatever. No. I'm like, so the next time, I'm like, hey, can I go for a smoke? She's like, no. And she, next time, she goes, like, oh, can I go for a smoke? She goes, no, you can't leave the hospital. And I was like, why? You're sectioned. And I was like, and I started to cry excessively. Because guess what? There was a moment that I didn't have to look after me anymore. That I had lost control and that they were going to look after me. And I felt safe.
Wow.
I felt that this was the one moment that I was like, oh, my God. And this is when someone's I was like, I'm done. I've hit the point. I tried to kill myself and I can't look after myself. And these people have to look after me.
Right.
And I was stoked. I was not stoked. Right? I was stoked.
No, but there is relief.
Yeah. Because I had I lost control of my life.
Right.
And someone else had taken control of my life and I didn't have a choice now.
Right.
And I felt safety in that. It was, it's still an amazing moment when I think about it. Cause it's like, it was the changing point of recovery for me.
Okay.
I was in the hospital for, I don't know, I think a week, 2 weeks. I don't know exactly. It's still, it's all a blur.
Right.
You guys, Umbrella came and visited me.
Okay.
I think, I remember that because I had the card when I got home.
Okay.
I ended up, that was, it was definitely like, now it was out in the open.
Sure.
My mom knew, like, I was like, oh my God. And my friends were like, well, yeah, I guess you do have a problem.
Right.
Yeah. I warned you guys. I told you I was depressed. I had my breakdowns. I warned you that I was like suicidal.
Right.
And I did it. But yeah, I ended up getting, so I get home, they let me go home because my mom's going to be with me for as long as I need to.
Okay.
She ends up being like the first week, I'm like basically laying on the floor, I'm crying. Or the first week out of the hospital there. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling things I've never felt before. I feel the worst I've ever felt in my life.
Okay.
And I'm going to mental health classes. They got me into bridging care at EMP,
right,
which is an extensive program. It's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, plus movement. And it's all do with right, like, kind of like people who have drug addiction and mental illness.
That's right. That's providing structure in your day and connection, right? At the end of the day.
But all I did is I could go to that. And then every hour I'd go for a walk around the block because that's the only thing I could do.
Right.
I couldn't go in community really. I was like, I could kind of do things, but I had so much anxiety and so much just like thoughts and feelings I never felt before. Right. And I wasn't numbing them.
So overwhelmed by life.
Everything.
Right.
And what I wouldn't do for an Ativan, but right, I didn't want one.
Right.
And what I understood was I need to ride through this. Yeah. And that it was going to get better, but it was going to get worse and right, it was going to get harder and it was going to be so much work.
Yeah.
So I ended that. I did my bridging care and, I don't even know what else. I started doing a program. I did CPT or CBT, CBD, cognitive behavioral therapy at, AOT, Island Health.
Right. Yeah.
I did some other programs there. I did the Comfortably Unnumb. That was my second thing right after bridging care.
Right.
My mom stayed with me for a month in the end. She kept asking every week, oh, is it all right if I go home? And I'm like, no, I'm not ready. I need to have someone here.
Yeah.
And she was amazing. She stayed with me and missed some things. We ended up because like, you know, I need her. I need someone to be there. Yeah. Or you know, now I think about it, I should have gone to treatment. Right. That would have probably been an interesting thing, but I didn't even know that existed.
Right.
And I don't know. I didn't even know. I knew detox existed, but like I had no interest in going there because I detoxed in the hospital when I was knocked out. So I wasn't really, and I didn't really, the Ativan or the barbiturates, I didn't really go through much of a withdrawal from them. I don't know.
So right now it was more just, you know, living with the reality of living life sober.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. So the physical detox is through.
Yeah.
But it's the, right. And so you're having some structure, obviously, in your days with the bridging care and then with Comfortably Numb, and you're building connections in recovery. Was that must have been a first for you too? Or
Yeah it was joining groups, going to RAS, joining groups and actually talking and meeting, knowing that I wasn't unique, that I was, other people experienced exactly the same thing as I did. Mm. Or not exactly, but other experiences that mimic what I had gone through. Mm. And that I wasn't special and that I could learn from them.
Mm.
And it was sad. It was like a lot of times during groups, I'd start crying because they would talk about something that would trigger things within me.
Mm.
And I spent a lot of time crying. Still do here and there. I have little teary times and all that, but it was learning to sit with my feelings, certain feelings. Like I still talk about like grief. Grief is something that I'm still dealing with. I'm still trying to go back to dealing with my dad's death and then my partner's death.
Right.
And now I'm using learning about grief of loss of like friendships and how grief can be loss of like jobs and all that. So I'm learning how to grieve.
Mm.
And I'm still stepping into the world of grieving for my partner, my dad here and there. But I was at first just doing that through hospice and through their programs they run for grief. They're excellent. Right. We get six of them for free. So what else did I ended up, recovery was, I sold my business. Mm-hmm. Within the first month of recovery, I put it up just as a, just get rid of it. I knew that I'd want to get rid of it for 5 years, 6 years.
Right.
And 7 years before that, I was offered $500,000 plus for it. And I ended up selling it for a fraction of that.
Right.
But it was one of the best days because guess what? I didn't have to deal with that anymore.
Right.
And I was
You can focus on you.
Yes.
Right.
And that's what I did. I got rid of everything that was, I didn't really care about. I didn't have money, but I had stuff. I had money in my bank. I didn't have money, but I had, what's it called? Lines of credit. Right. So I was like, I'm just going to, I have to live my life. I'm not going to be extravagant. Mm-hmm. I'm going back to basics, but I'm just looking after me. I came first. I wasn't going to get in relationships. Right. Wasn't looking because previously a lot of times I would end up jumping when I had trauma. I'd jump to another partner, find a partner, and there you go.
Yeah.
Redirect those feelings into love, where I thought was life, love. But no, I ended up sitting with all this stuff. And I didn't get a job for a little bit. And then instead of getting a job where my skills were, I used to work way back. I worked with people with disabilities in group homes, I ran my own programs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I can't remember when that one was. And I worked in the school board at one point too. But I ended up looking for a basic job that just gave me routine and stability.
Right.
And I started off simple. I started off with just 2 days a week, and I wanted to see. And I told them that I was in recovery, that, I didn't say mental illness, but I said I was recovery from drugs. And I just want this. I want to see if I like this, if I can do this, because I didn't know. And I was a bellman at a hotel.
Okay.
It was funny because it was the most easiest job I've ever had.
Right.
But it gave me exactly what I needed. It gave me stability, and it gave me routine, mm-hmm. and it gave me a reason to get up. And my anxiety, it was so bad that every day going to work, I'd almost vomit, shaking in the car, really bad anxiety. And it slowly has disappeared. I can do things that I never would think I'd ever done. And that was having the job, always challenging myself, always pushing myself. A program I took part in was RAS, which is out of, an Island Health in the Pembroke Clinic. Mm-hmm. I could give it a pump for it. I always pump it up. It operates every day, Monday through Mondays, 365 days of the year. And it's from 10:30 to 12:30 or 10:30 till 12.
10:30 to 12.
Yeah. And it's CBT-based, cognitive behavior therapy-based learning with a check-in and all that. I love it.
Right. Well, it's such a, I always think that RAS is such a great program. Yeah. The accessibility, the fact that it's every day, the fact that you have regular people that come there, and it's quite a community, but then also at the end of it, you get a pool pass and a bus ticket. So you can go off, you can go off to the gym afterwards or go to the pool, and it helps create a really healthy routine.
It does.
Yeah,
it does. And if you don't have any other routine, I'd say it's a very important thing because it's every day you can go.
Right.
But I ended up, I somehow got to where I am by putting in a lot of work.
Yeah.
I've done every group that Umbrella runs from every one of them.
Yeah, you said yes to pretty much everything.
Everything. Yeah. I said yes to all. I'm reintroducing myself to NA and AA.
Right.
Because throughout my addiction world, I've always gone to that. I've tried it here and there throughout. I didn't bring it up because it never worked for me.
Right.
So, but now I'm retrying that. Smart recovery, I do that. I actually facilitate that.
That's right.
But it's another excellent one. But for me, it was I had to try something. Like one of the things I did at the beginning was I tried something new every day.
Okay.
And I still do that to this day. I still try to do something new once a week, challenge myself, push my boundaries. I don't want to be that person standing on the sidelines going, oh, I wish I did that. I wish I did this. Because guess what? I can do it. And I've learned that I can do some things that I never thought I could do. Right. And life has become, it's hard still. And I was going to say it's become amazing. But no, guess what? I'm in recovery. And every day is a challenge. Every day ends up being, I have to wake up and I do my gratitude. And I thank I thank for having a home. I'm thankful for the sun. I'm thankful for the moon coming up. I'm thankful for being alive. And I'm thankful for my job. I'm thankful for all these things. And I can always find something to be thankful for. And I know that at any point I could lose it all. And that was what addiction would do.
Right.
But it's a job. It's another job on top of a job. It's being in recovery. I have to, I still go to, after 2 years and a bit, I still go to probably 4 or 5 programs, meetings a week. Right. I still take part in groups.
Yeah.
Because guess what? It is always in the background. It will sneak up and it will take me down again. And I'm not, I don't want to go down again.
Right.
But it's work. So it's my other work on top of work is recovery.
Sure.
But what I get out of it is I've never been the happiest in my life. Right. And my mom said something that was the most amazing thing. About 6 months, a year into this, and she turned around and she said, "You're the happiest I've ever seen you." And that is something that's like,
wow,
just sat and was like, it's the truth. Like I am, I feel good,
yeah,
healthy. I still have aches and pains. I'm 50 years old.
Right.
But I can get through every day.
Right.
I can have these challenges show up. I can have these adverse moments and I have the ability to deal with them in a rational way. Be able to like move forward and learn from them, which is unbelievable. Like I look at some of these moments and I can learn from them.
Right.
Which I
right.
love. And it's right. like this, the gift that recovery has given me is that I'm living again and that this life is, I can get anything out of it and I'm right. gonna, it's going to be great.
Yeah. No, you know what? And I'll say, you know, a couple things that really, you know, that for me watching you in your recovery is your commitment to your recovery. And I think you said it, it is a job and you work it. And there was a great line that someone who came through our house that said that he was inserting life back into recovery, not recovery into life. And I love that. And I feel like, you know, you kind of live by that model. And I love to hear when you're like, oh yeah, I checked out this new group or, and the fact that you're, you know, still working so actively there are, you know, I think a lot of, you know, when people have missteps in recovery, a lot of times it's taking that foot off the gas, you know, too early, you know, and thinking, oh, I've been doing this for a year. I got this, you know, and I just don't think that you have that mentality. And like I said, a lot of times when you see success is, when people continue to commit to it, you know, and continue to like that trying new things. I think that's amazing, right? It's going, what I'm doing now might be working, but I need more. I need a little bit of something else. I need to keep things fresh and I need to keep it in the forefront, you know? So I you know, I'm really, really grateful about on that side that you've kind of figured that out. You also, you know, didn't mention you've entered the workforce. So you're, you know, you've been working for us.
Yeah.
Now for a year.
To that yet.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, what gave you that? So you were working as a bellboy. Or did you call it bellboy? Is that the
bellman?
Bellman, sorry.
I think it should be bell person. Actually.
Yes, a bell person. Yeah. So you're.
So I did that for about.
What gave you that thought to? Because I remember when you reached out to me, and you know, what gave you that idea that this field might, you know, this is the time.
Because I felt like I could give back, but I wanted to give myself a year, and I wanted to try everything, all the programs out there, so I'd have a background. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have my sobriety, my recovery to be in the forefront. And I knew that like Umbrella offered like that I could try it out. And that's how I came into it. I was like, yeah, I'd be interested in a job, but maybe just like, you know, 2 days a week maybe. Mm-hmm. And I just want to see if I'm all right with it. Right. I may not be. And you were comfortable with saying, okay, that's cool. You're just like, you're not jumping in. No, mm-hmm. no. And I'd worked with people with disabilities before and I'm a caring person. I was like, you know what? It felt good. But I was more in harm reduction at that point. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, and yeah, Umbrella was pretty amazing with the, gosh, I keep pumping you guys.
Yeah,
I guess I'm on your podcast, so I should.
Eh? Right.
give
I'm not
a shout
complaining.
Out.
Yeah.
But yeah, the ability that you guys gave me a chance, but I believe it too was like, I gave it a year. Gave a year in recovery that I was strong in. Mm-hmm. I felt strong. You know, it's still going to be the most important thing, but you guys gave me the chance to come in here and practice and try and to see if I liked it. And I enjoyed it enough that I ended up coming on full time, moved through it a little bit. Now I've done a little bit of hospitals, tried some other some island health teams.
That's right.
But then I really enjoy doing the smart recovery meetings. And the uncomfortably numb doing.
That's right. So yeah, you've kind of your venture into facilitation has been great, and it's been very well received.
Thank you.
So many people come and say, I love having Jeff at Smart Recovery. So that's a big one. And yeah, and a little bit of full circle, you know, coming in now, you know, I asked you to come and facilitate it at Comfortably Numb, and I think you'd express some interest. I think I got you in the first couple times doing CBT, and you're like, you know what? This just isn't me. I want to do gratitude. And it was a piece that we had in the past for Comfortably Numb, and we had dropped for the last few. And so for me, I thought, well, this is great, you know, because we kind of want to fill this gap. But it was also something that you're passionate about.
And
the response was unanimous and overwhelming that this was a great move. Can you talk about your experience a little bit? And I think, you know, the way that you're even explaining it to me that, you know, how I think it's such a great outlook, and gratitude is something that is, you know, for me, it's such a, it can be a real key piece, right? And it's something that can be overlooked.
It's an interesting one, because gratitude is something where we take things for granted, and you have to remove that we're blessed every day with like the ability to stand up, the ability to breathe, the ability to see. Like, it's simple things like that are just like, we take for granted. And like, starting off with gratitude is strange, because first, like, I took the class here and I was like, this is a joke.
Right. I was like, it can seem a little much, ever. Right?
Oh, yeah. And I tell people in my gratitude class, I go, hey, it's going to come off a little religious without God.
Right.
It's going to come, I'm going to tell you how great this is and how it makes you feel good. But guess what? At first, you're going to feel, I felt stupid.
Right.
I was doing my gratitude practice. I was writing my gratitudes. I was like, this is dumb as hell.
Right.
Yeah, good gratitude. Great. It added to my other things I did. Like, I do my affirmations in the morning, my high fives. I read out my, Jeff is, I am loved. I am this.
Right.
Am.
Sure. Yeah.
But gradually gratitude, I just ended up becoming, how am I going to say it? A way of life. It's like a feeling of like, you go outside, it's mindfulness, it's everything. You stand outside and you just experience life. And when you're grateful for it, gratitude brings happiness.
Mm-hmm.
It's not happiness, or is it happiness brings gratitude? No, gratitude.
It's like almost the discipline of being happy, I think is a good way to put it, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is, and it's like you say, it does feel a little bit forced and a little bit weird at first, right?
Yeah.
But that discipline, that practice does start, like you say, start becoming a way of life and a different way to look at the world, right? You know, it reframes, right?
Yes.
It reframes.
Yeah. And it brings, just saying it makes me happy, makes me feel happy. And it's, and there's a whole bunch of stuff within recovery, like that is that you have to try it and you have to laugh at it and then you have to do it. And there's certain practices you'll be like, this really isn't me.
Right.
But then you'll find ones you'll sit with a little bit and you're like, okay, this maybe this has something behind it. And then one day you'll be, oh my God, I'm practicing this and it's working. And that's the thing. It's like gratitude is something where it works. It's like, I'm like, oh yeah, I catch myself, you know, my emotions kind of getting a little out of control. And I'm like, take a breath, stop.
Right.
Just stop for a moment.
Right.
I'm not going to take anything personally.
It's the way to bring us back in the present moment and appreciate where we are.
Yeah.
right. Yeah. I think that's such a, for me, I think it's a real key piece. It's, you know, there's also this, I didn't realize this, but I was watching this documentary on neuroscience, and they basically said that practicing gratitude, even if you don't have anything to be grateful for, just seeking something to be grateful for accesses your reward center. So you get this dopamine hit. But then perversely, so does shame and guilt and embarrassment.
Guilt. Don't get on
so,
that.
So, you know, for me, it's like, man, you've got this choice. It's making a conscious choice. We got our low-hanging fruit with the shame and guilt sitting here that I can't believe. You're accessing the reward center through that or through gratitude. So it's actually making that conscious choice, I think, right?
And listening and seeing acts of gratitude. This is an unbelievable one. Seeing two people like are hearing someone thanking someone else.
Right.
It's residual gratification. You feel good from it.
Right.
And it's like, that is something where I was like, oh, wow. Like, gratitude doesn't have to be necessarily you thanking someone or someone thanking you. And this is a part two, is someone thanking you and accepting that you are being thanked. That is amazing. One, like, I used to laugh at people that would be like, oh, they'd be like, oh, Jeff, you did a great job. I'm like, whatever. I'm, like, I'm shitty. Right. You know, I know I'm shitty. You don't have to tell me that. And now I go, I'm like, you're lying to me. I'm not good.
Right. Right.
Oh, I won an award. Oh, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
No, I end up being like, now
take it.
Someone says, hey, thank you for doing a good job. I'm like, hey, and I feel it. I accept it that I do a good job. Right. And that makes me feel so good inside. Right. Where instead of my, like, negative thoughts pushing it away, but like watching, like, you know, watching someone, like, being around people that are nice to each other is good. Right. It's just good.
Right. God, yeah. Maybe I'm like, oh. Yeah. No, I said, and but it takes time. And I think that there is, I think you brought up something, trying things in recovery, and at first it may feel weird, and you just work through that, and it's going to give it time to stick and take root. Right. And I think that that's it. A lot of times we dismiss things, or we don't give it enough of a chance.
We feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. We feel uncomfortable. Oh, it's like, oh, you know what? That's, yeah, you know, screw that. That's not for me. That's not for me. Yep. That's, well, you know what? There comes a point where you got to give it that time to sit in and actually have that effect. It's not going to happen overnight.
I found like I was starting trying. That's the whole thing where you try new things. I was like, okay, cool. And then I end up being, try things that you didn't like. Look back in your childhood, and I was like, okay, you know, I hate mushrooms, I hate tomatoes. Guess what? I don't mind them now. Oh, I hate doing this activity. Right. I have no idea where that thought came from. Right. 30 years ago, I created this image of that. I hate this thing.
You're breaking down these core beliefs. Yeah, right? They just get set. Yeah.
I'm like, why? There's no reason for that. Right. Why should I feel that? Why should I think about this thing? So that's why I brought it into one thing, was trying things you don't like. And people were like, what do you, why would I do that? I said, when did you decide you hate that? Huh? They'll be like, I don't know. I've always. Yeah. Why?
Right.
I don't know. I always have.
Challenging core beliefs. Yeah. Oh, amazing. Yeah. So listen, I mean, I think I could listen to you chat forever here. This has been like such a treat to, you know, and thank you for like being vulnerable. That is quite a profound story. You have,
we're going to talk about vulnerability now?
Okay, well.
No, that's good.
I mean, so I do, you know, we got to wrap it up, but I do want to ask, like when you see somebody new come into your smart recovery, or somebody who's kind of in that, at that point, you know, where you were, where you're just kind of contemplating making a change, or maybe you've just started just early in recovery. What do you say to someone like that? Do you have some like words of wisdom that you impart, or do you just kind of let it ride?
It's going to be one of the hardest things you're ever going to do, but there's so many supports in Victoria, especially. Go out there and try everything. Contact Island Health. Contact Umbrella. Go to the groups. Try things. Try every group you possibly can. And it will get better.
Right.
But it's going to be a long... There's no end game in this.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You're going to be in recovery for the rest of your life. Right. So don't get over the idea that, hey, in 1 year... I'm going to be fine. Oh, yes. In 2 years, I'm going to be fine. Oh,
right.
Right. This is a way of life. And there's a community out there. Right. And embrace that community, because that's going to be your main community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Amazing. I love that, man. And I love, you know, I will say you're one of the most authentic people, you know, I think I've met. I think that's why people are drawn to you, is your authenticity kind of shines through. And I love that you don't candy coat stuff. You know, some people try to, you know, no, I'm not glossing over it. Yeah, this is fucking hard work. But guess what? It's worth it. And so, you know, I really appreciate, you know, I don't think you could be anything but honest. And I love it, you know, so, you know. Cool.
Thank you.
Well, and yeah, this has been, it's been a real pleasure, and thanks for jumping in at the last minute. I'm so glad I asked you. So
I really appreciate you asking me. That was wonderful. It's great to talk to you. It's great to see you. It's great to be in your office, your new office here.
I know. Isn't it a lot better than my old office? I'll
tell you. Did you have an office?
It was quite an upgrade.
Well, I remember that was in the candy shack.
That's right. It's in a little storage room in the back.
It was a closet.
No window. It was a closet. Yeah.
It was a closet.
So look at this. We're moving up in life. All right. Well, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Wow. I'm actually blown away right now. Thank you so much to Jeff for coming on and telling such a powerful story. You know, I think for me, I had not heard Jeff's entire story, even close to Jeff's entire story until today. And what really struck me Jeff is such a happy-go-lucky, easygoing guy, and to hear the hardship that he's gone through, it really is a demonstration that, you know, happiness and an outlook on life, it's a bit of a discipline. It's something that you really have to work at. You just don't wake up one day and expect to be happy. It is something that you need to work at, and finding gratitude and acceptance, you know, is not something that comes overnight. It's a discipline, and it comes with a lot of hard work and dedication. And, you know, Jeff is an example of how that can pay dividends for you. So yeah, really proud of Jeff for how far he's come, but also incredibly grateful that he can come on and share such a powerful story with everybody. You know, I'm continually blown away by the caliber and class of people that we have on this program, and such powerful stories that they are willing to share. This isn't easy. So we will have in 2 weeks' time another wonderful individual coming onto this program to share their story. These stories will continue to come. We need to keep on spreading the word that recovery is possible, and everybody's journey looks different, but everybody can get there. Nobody is down and out enough to get the help and to recover and find quality of life for them and for their family. Please, if you have a family member that is struggling, or if you yourself are struggling, reach out to the Umbrella Society or any supports in the towns and communities that you're in, and get those supports and you know, start moving towards a life of recovery. Everyone can do it. Recovery is possible. Until we see you again in a couple of weeks, my name is Blake Anderson from Umbrella Society. Thank you very much.